2 seats on the plane to Krakow, and it leaves at 11. I bought them yesterday. If you'd rather sleep and just stay here, okay. I'll be back in a couple of days. Half awake, Byron said, What? Sloat's got us on a plane to Rome tomorrow, Natalie, and those reservations were mighty hard to come by. I know, I'll leave him a note. Maybe I'll phone him from the airport. If you come, we won't have to return to Warsaw at all. We'll go straight on to Rome from Krakow, Saturday or Sunday, after I visit my family. Have you got reservations from there? No, but Krakow's a hub. There are half a dozen ways to get out. We'll buy our tickets, plane or train or bus, as soon as we arrive there. Well? Byron, have you fallen back asleep? I'm thinking. Byron was weighing the advantage of leaving Warsaw and Sloat against these harebrained travel arrangements. The war crisis seemed to be abating. The Poles in the nightclubs had acted gay and carefree, though Sloat had remarked on the absence of foreigners, especially Germans. The streets were as calm as ever, and there were no visible preparations for war. Byron had taken to gauging the state of the crisis by the tone of Radio Warsaw. He now knew a few key words and phrases about the crisis, and much could sometimes be surmised from the shaky or relieved accents of the newscasters. In the United States, announcers in a time of crisis tended to use sonorous, doom-filled voices to thrill their listeners. The Polish broadcasters, nearer the action, were less bent on being dramatic. In the past day or two, they had not sounded quite so worried. He said, Have you heard any news? I just got BBC on shortwave. Same bulletins as last night. Henderson's talking to Hitler. Natalie, this would be a damned wild excursion. Why? I'll probably never have another chance to see where my parents were born. I'm here now. Leslie himself said last night that the worst seems to be over, and they've agreed to negotiate. Anyway, you don't have to come. I mean that. It'll be a bore for you, slogging around in the Polish countryside. Well, I'll have breakfast with you. Byron packed fast. The more time he spent with Natalie Jastrow, the more she puzzled him. Her relationship with Leslie Sloat now baffled him, too. If they were spending time in bed together, and he had to assume that this was part of her purpose in coming to Warsaw, if not all of it, they were finding odd, hurried occasions for this, or taking pains to mislead him. Night after night, Sloat had said his farewells in the hotel lobby. She treated Sloat, when they were together, with the loving warmth of a fiancé. Yet, when Byron tried to withdraw from their company, for dinner, for a concert, or the theater, even for a tour of the embassy, she made him come along. It had crossed his mind, of course, that she might be using him, perhaps had even asked him along to Warsaw, to provoke Sloat. If so, the tactic was failing. The Foreign Service man was cordial to Byron and appeared to take his tagging along entirely for granted. But it was hard to tell anything about Sloat, except that he was weary, swamped with work, and very concerned about Natalie's presence in Poland. There had been more to her persistence in the journey, that was becoming clear to Byron, than desire for her lover. The Jewish streets of Warsaw fascinated her. No matter where they started an evening, they ended in those narrow byways. She had even dragged Byron, Sloat had begged off, to a performance of O'Neill's Ah, Wilderness at a little Yiddish theater in a back alley, with a stage not 20 feet wide and a ragged curtain. For him, it was a bizarre and tedious experience, but the mixture of apple-pie American characters and stylized Jewish emoting in that shabby hall had much amused and moved her. "That was me, I guess," she had said, coming out of the theater into the warm night, in the muddy alley bordered with sagging, half-timbered houses. That exact strange mixture. I never quite understood that, and I'm still sorting it out. It's disconcerting but exciting. like seeing myself for the first time in a home movie. Evidently, this same fascination was drawing her to Medjich. She was waiting for him in the restaurant. Somewhere she had bought a Polish dress, a bright, flowery print with an open neck, and she had combed her heavy hair forward, covering much of her forehead in an outdated American style, as the Warsaw women did. "Will I get by? I'm so bored with all these stares, as though I had horns."
"So long as you've got your passport handy, okay. Don't go too native."
"Oh, sure. And there's always this." At her feet was a blue suede sack with drawstrings. "Suit, shirt, hat, stockings, girdle. I can go into a lady's room any time and emerge a complete Amerikanka, full of indignation and waving dollars.
Are you coming?"
"No, of course."
"Yes, my bag's in the lobby."
"Honestly? Oh, you're as goofy as I am, Briny."
She looked at him from under her eyebrows, with a slow blink of her dark eyes, and Byron thought of the little ghetto girl in the lilac dress.
"Tell me, don't you like Sloat a little better now?"
"I don't dislike him. I'm sorry for him at the moment. He's certainly in over his head." The waitress put down plates of food. He said, "Well, you ordered for both of us. Fine. There's nothing like this Polish ham."
She said, "I'm even beginning to feel slightly guilty here, eating ham. Imagine."
Natalie cut and ate the thick pink meat with no visible remorse. "I don't know anything about your religion," Byron said.
"Neither do I, and it's hardly my religion. I dropped it before I was 11 years old. Temple, Hebrew classes, everything. It grieved my father. He's a Zionist, an officer in the temple and all that. But our rabbi was such a boring dunce, Briny, and my father simply couldn't answer my questions. He's not an intellectual like Aaron. He's a businessman. When I was 11, I'd read more books than he had."
"But he just allowed you to drop it?" Byron said. "Like that? My father wouldn't have, that's for sure."
"Possibly military men are different," Natalie said with a skeptical smile. "Most fathers can't do much with daughters. Anyway, I was an only child, and very good, on the whole. I just wouldn't keep up flummery that made no sense to me. Well," she set her knife and fork down, "coffee and then on to Medjich, correct?"
"I'm with you."
A rickety taxi, with thick surgical tape crisscrossing the cracked yellow windows, brought them to the airport. The lone aircraft on the sunny field looked so rusty and patched that Byron thought it might be a wreck. But as they arrived, people came out on the grass and began boarding it.
"I don't know," Byron said as he paid the cab driver. "Do you suppose it will leave the ground? Maybe we should have this fellow wait."
Natalie laughed and went to telephone Sloat, but he was not in his apartment nor at the embassy. The terminal was still crowded with Germans, though so few seemed left in Warsaw. Only Poles and a few Jews boarded the Krakow plane and took the awkward iron seats. The plane did leave the ground, with bumps and shutters that slightly parted the metal floor plates, affording a view underfoot of green fields and admitting a jet of warm air that billowed Natalie's skirt. She tucked it under her thighs and fell asleep. After a half hour or so, the plane dived, slamming down to a stop near a barn in an open field, amid tall grass and wildflowers. Byron thought it was a forced landing, but several passengers took their valises and got off. Another hop of about an hour brought them to Krakow, the plain passing from green flatlands to low mountains, part forested, part farmed, all checkered with fields of yellow, black, and purple. The Krakow terminal was a wooden hut inside a wire fence. Byron was glad to leave the plain, which reeked of hot iron and gasoline, and to walk out on a sunny, breezy field as fragrant as a flower garden. On either side of the tarred landing strip, kerchiefed peasant women were mowing hay in the sunshine. There were no taxis in sight, and only one mud-caked green bus. Some passengers, met by their relatives, climbed into heavy, horse-drawn wagons and went creaking off. "Any idea how we get to Krakow?" Byron said.
"That bus must go there," Natalie said.
A brown-bearded Jew, standing alone and erect at the gate, in a long dark coat and a wide, flat, dark hat, drew near, touching his hat with his hand.
"You excuse, Americans? Jastrow?"
Natalie regarded him dubiously.
"Why, yes. You're not Beryl."
"Yes, yes, Yochanan Beryl Jastrow."
He broke into a broad smile.
"You excuse, poor English. Speak you Deutsch, Francais?"
"Francais un peu."
And she switched into French.
"How did you know we'd be on this plane? Well, Byron, this is Uncle Aaron's cousin, my father's cousin. Byron Henry is a good friend of mine, Beryl."
The two men shook hands, and the Jew smoothed his long, gray-flecked brown beard, scanning Byron's face. Beryl Jastrow had a broad nose, heavy eyebrows, and surprisingly blue, deep-set eyes with an almost Tartar slant. His glance was incisive. Byron felt that Jastrow classed him in a second or two as a Gentile, though probably a friendly one.
"Enchanté," Jastrow said.
He led them to a rust-pitted car on the other side of the shed. The driver was a scrawny man in a light sweater and a skullcap, with a little bright red beard. After a parley in Yiddish, they set off. Natalie explained to Byron that they were going straight to Medjic. The Jastrow family was agog to see her, and Krakow was 20 miles the other way. They regarded it as a wonderful omen that the American cousin was falling on them from the skies the day before the wedding. Natalie had telegraphed to Yochanan Jastrow Medjic, saying she expected to arrive today, but she had not mentioned the plane, scarcely expecting that the wire would reach him.
"Mais pourquoi pas? La Pologne n'est pas l'Afrique,"
Beryl interjected, brightly following Natalie's English.
"C'est un pays tout à fait moderne et civilisé."
Byron found it decidedly peculiar to hear clear, good French spoken by this figure out of a ghetto painting or play. Jastrow told him he would arrange for their return to Rome the day after tomorrow. He had good connections in Krakow, and getting train or air tickets would be no problem at all. Swerving to avoid the worst holes, the car bounced along a bad tar road. They drove through tiny villages of straw-thatched log houses painted with strips of blue between the logs. The driver had to maneuver around pigs, chickens, and cattle wandering in the road. Many of the houses were weathered gray, sagging, or toppling. Some had no windows, but nearly all had new or freshly varnished doors. Close to each village, on a rise of ground, stood a church of wood. In the sun-flooded fields, women and men toiled with hand implements or horse-drawn plows. The car passed massive wagons of hand-hewn wood, pulled by muscular, resigned horses, and driven by muscular, resigned women and men, their sex indistinguishable except for marks like kerchiefs and beards. No tractor or automobile or any other machine appeared along the way until they came to Oświęcim, a medium-sized railroad town of brick buildings and wide streets, cut in two by a muddy river. Here the car stopped in the main square at the telephone exchange, and Natalie got out with Beryl to phone Sloat. Byron strolled around the square in the hot sun, attracting covert looks from the townspeople. He bought ice cream, and the shop girl took his money without a word. Oświęcim was nothing like Warsaw, a flat town of low, drab buildings with an air of backcountry dislike of strangers. Byron was glad to leave it. Natalie told him, as they drove out into level green fields on a dirt road along the river, that Sloat, furious and alarmed, had said uncomplimentary things about Byron's intelligence, though she had tried to take all the blame on herself. "I think he's got a case of nerves," she said. "You don't suppose he's afraid of the Germans?" Look, it was an unceremonious way to leave him. She said, with an odd little glance at Byron, "It wasn't all that unceremonious. We were together till dawn, you know, talking. He ought to be tired of me." "What? I saw you turn in at 3. "Oh, yes, but then he rang me from the lobby, said he was too exhausted to sleep or something, and I came down and we went out again." "I see. You must be really beat." "Strangely enough, I feel wonderful. The nap on the plane, and now all this sweet country air. Poland smells delicious. I never read that in a book."
"Poland is a first-class country,"
Beryl spoke up in English, stroking his beard.
"Strong people. Hitler a big bluff. No war."
Byron's stay in Medjic remained in his memory forever after as something like a trip to the moon. Though the usual church stood on the usual knoll, the villagers were almost all Jews. Medjic was a cluster of houses on crooked, narrow dirt or cobbled streets, some log, some plastered, a few brick, sloping down toward a flat green meadow and the winding river. About a mile beyond the town, a roofless great house in the style of a French chateau lay ruined on the riverbank. The noble family was extinct. The house was a casualty of the World War, but the village survived. The Jastrows and their relatives seemed to comprise half of Medjic. They swarmed on Natalie and Byron and marched them joyously from home to home. The dark interiors were all much the same. Tiny rooms, enormous stoves, heavy, polished Victorian furniture, lace curtains. Each house seething underfoot with children ranging from crawlers to adolescents. Wine, cake, tea, hard candies, vodka, and fish appeared on table after table. There was no polite way to refuse. After a while, Byron was physically uncomfortable, because there was never a toilet pause. In all the hours that this was going on, he never understood a word that anybody said. It seemed to him that all the Jews talked continuously and simultaneously. Natalie chatted away with these bearded men in dark blouses, breeches, and heavy boots, these unpainted, work-worn women in plain dresses that reached their ankles. They all appeared enthralled by her. Outside each house, a crowd gathered, joining the conversation through the windows. The visit of the two Americans was obviously one of the grandest events in Medjic since the war. What a world! No sidewalks, no shops, no movie houses, no garages, no cars, no bicycles, no street lights, no hydrants, no billboards, not a sound, not a sight to connect the town with the 20th century, except a string of telegraph poles stretching along the river. Yet Natalie Jastrow was only one generation removed from this place. Dr. Aaron Jastrow, the author of A Jew's Jesus, the full professor of history at Yale, the urbane friend of the Archbishop of Siena, had lived here until his 15th year, and had looked like one of these pale, skinny, studious boys in big black skullcaps and ear curls. Byron could not imagine what these people made of him, but they were fully as cordial to him as to Natalie, substituting smiles and gestures for the talk with which they flooded her. The next day, Natalie told him that she had identified him as her protector, an American naval officer sent along by Uncle Aaron. They had accepted this without question, since anything Americans did was equally unlikely and shocking and marvelous. The sleeping arrangements that night were as novel as everything else. Byron was quartered at the home of the rabbi. This was the outcome of a tremendous argument in which half the population participated, including, at one point, the village priest, a brown-bearded man who, except for his bare head and black robe, rather resembled Beryl, and whose sudden appearance on the scene sobered everybody. The parleying language shifted to Polish, then to German, which Byron well understood. The priest wanted to extend his hospitality to the Gentile American. Beryl managed, with a timely word of help in German from Byron, to deflect this offer. When the priest left, both Beryl and Byron became the center of jubilant triumph, and the American was borne off to the rabbi's brick house by an escort of singing, hand-clapping yeshiva boys, led by the bridegroom himself, a pale lad of 18 or so, with a wispy goatee. Here the rabbi and his wife tried to give him their own bed, but since it was obviously exactly that, the only large bed in the house, a black four-poster piled with huge pillows, Byron wouldn't have it. This caused another grand parley in Yiddish. The house had a second bedroom containing two beds and a plank and mattress stretched across two chairs. In this room there were already five tittering girls who, as the discussion went on, began blushing and roaring with laughter. The idea seemed to be to put Byron into one of those beds. Evidently, no decent solution could be hammered out. He ended up sleeping on the floor of the main room, a sort of parlor and dining room combined, lined with giant leather-bound books. The rabbi gave him a feather mattress to lie on, and as six of the boys from the Krakow yeshiva shared the floor with him on similar mattresses, he did not feel ill-treated. Indeed, he slept better on the floor of the rabbi's house in Medjich than he had in Warsaw's Europejski Hotel. He found the feather mattress lulling. He spent much of the next day walking with Natalie around the town and in the fields and along the river, past an old cemetery to the ruined great house. The preparations for the wedding were going forward, so today the family let the visitors amuse themselves. The muddy, narrow streets of Medjich. It had rained hard during the night, and the rattling on the rabbi's roof had increased Byron's sense of snugness, were filled with an autumnal fragrance of hay and ripening fruit, made more tangy by the smells of the free-roaming ducks, chickens, goats, and calves. Some of the fowl were encountering tragedy, happily strutting in the morning sunshine one moment, and the next swooped down upon by laughing children and carried off squawking and flapping to be slaughtered. In the fields beyond the outlying houses and barns, mostly one-room log structures with heavy yellow thatch roofs, cows and horses grazed in tall waving grass spotted with wildflowers. Water bugs skated on the surface of the slow-moving brown river. Fish jumped and splashed, but nobody was fishing. Natalie told him she had stayed up half the night talking to the family. Most of what she had heard was news to her. Her father had tended to reminisce more about Warsaw than about his birthplace, and as a child she had been bored by the little she had heard, since she had only wanted to be a true blue American. In the village, Uncle Aaron and her father were the legendary ones who had made an American success. Aaron Jastrow was variously thought to be a great surgeon, an astronomer, and a cancer specialist. Professor had ambiguous meanings in Polish and Yiddish. Nobody but Beryl knew that he had written a famous book about Jesus, and Natalie gathered that Aaron's cousin was at some pains to keep the achievement quiet. Beryl, this was a familiar name for Yohanan, his real name, was the local success. He had begun trading in mushrooms while still a student in Krakow, had branched into other exports, and had prospered enough to move his family to Warsaw. But he had sent his son back to the Krakow yeshiva, and had found the boy a bride in Medjich among the second cousins. The numerous Jastrows, like the rest of the villagers, lived by farming and by selling dairy products in the markets of Oswiecim and Krakow. Clamoring around the ruined great house, Natalie went exploring out of sight, broke through some rotten flooring, and fell 10 or 12 feet. Byron heard the splintering noise, her shriek, and the thud. He hurried to find her. She lay sprawled like a broken doll, her skirt up around her gartered white thighs. She had landed on dirt and thick grass. Whatever the floor here had been, probably parquet or marble, nothing was left of it. Byron pulled down her skirt and lifted her to a sitting position. She was conscious but stunned and greenish pale. In a minute or two her color returned, and life and amusement flowed back into her eyes. She shook her head. "Ye gods, I really saw stars, Byron. I thought I'd broken my silly neck." She put her head on his shoulder. "Glory, what a scare. I'm all right. Help me up." She limped. Her left knee bothered her, she said. She took his arm with an abashed grin and leaned on him. Byron had tried to keep her from climbing the decayed staircase, and the grin was her only apology, but it was enough. He was worried by the injury, and still angry over her casual disclosure that she had been with Sloat until dawn the day before. However, to have this girl leaning on him in a sunlit orchard full of apple scent by a river seemed to Byron almost all the pleasure he wanted in the world. Just holding her like this was sweeter than any delight any other girl had ever given him. Whatever it was that made a girl desirable, the enigmatic look in the eyes, the soft curve of a cheek, the shape of a mouth, the sudden charm of a smile, the swell of breasts and hips under a dress, the smoothness of skin, Natalie Jastrow, for Byron, was all composed of these lovely glints, all incandescent with them. That she stemmed from the strange Jews of Medjich, that she was, by all evidence, the mistress of a dour man 10 years older than himself, that she was only a solid and human girl, indeed, very heavy, leaning on him and limping, with a stubborn streak and some unattractive, almost coarse tomboy bravado, all these drawbacks just made her Natalie Jastrow, instead of the perfect girl he had been dreaming about since his 12th year. The perfect girl had, in fact, been a blonde and something of a sex fiend, like the dream girls of most boys. She was gone now, and this prickly, Jewish brunette held her place. And here they were alone on a riverbank in South Poland, in golden sunshine, a mile from any house, amid apple trees laden with ripe fruit. "This will be slow work getting back," she said. "I can try to carry you." "What, a horse like me? You'd rupture yourself. I'm fine if I keep my weight off it. It's just such a bore."
"I'm not bored," said Byron.
They passed an old abandoned scow half full of water. "Let's use this," he said, tipping it to empty it out. Natalie appreciatively watched him heave up the scow unaided.
"No oars," she said. "We can float downstream."
He guided the scow with a long rough plank that lay in it, using the plank as a rudder and as a pole. The river was very sluggish, almost oily, calm and brown. Natalie sat on the bow edge of the scow, facing Byron, her shoes in the seeping water. She said as they floated past the cemetery,
"That's where all my ancestors are, I guess, the ones that aren't buried in Palestine."
"Or Egypt or Mesopotamia," Byron said. Natalie shuddered.
I don't know. It's a godforsaken place, Briny.
Medjich?
Poland. I'm glad Grandma and Grandpa got the hell out of here.
He banked the scow near the village. She climbed out and walked slowly, not limping. There was no doctor here, she said, and she didn't want to generate a crisis around the injured American cousin. She would have her knee taped in Krakow tomorrow. None of the villagers noticed anything the matter with her. Byron tried to find out the war crisis news. There was one working radio in Medjich, and several broken-down ones. The priest had the working radio. The rabbi told Byron, in Yiddish, tortured into a barely comprehensible kind of German, that the last broadcast from Warsaw had been encouraging. The Prime Minister of England had gone to his country home for the weekend, and the crisis seemed to be passing.
"Henderson, Henderson," the rabbi said. "Henderson talked to Hitler."
And he winked shrewdly, rubbing one hand over the other to pantomime a money deal. The wedding made Byron wish over and over that he were a writer and could record it. A Jew and could comprehend it. The mixture of solemnity and boisterousness baffled him. In his training, decorousness was the essence of a wedding, except for the shoes and rice moment at the very end. But the Medjich Jews, though arrayed in their best, the women in velvet dresses and the men in black satin coats or formal city clothes, did not seem to know what decorum was. They crowded, they chattered, they burst into song, they surrounded the veiled, silent, seated bride and discussed her vehemently. They danced, they marched here and there in the houses and in the streets, performing strange little rites. One and then another stood on a chair to speak or to sing, and the guests wildly laughed and wildly cried. The pallid bridegroom, in a white robe and a black hat, looked on the verge of fainting. Byron accidentally learned, by offering him a plate of cakes at the long men's table, where the American visitor sat in a place of honor beside the groom, that the weedy boy had been fasting for 24 hours, and still was, while everybody around him continuously ate and drank with vast appetite. Byron, eating and drinking with the rest, and feeling very good indeed, was not sure for hours whether the marriage ceremony had or had not taken place. But near midnight, a sudden gravity fell on the guests. In a courtyard, with the bright moon and a blaze of stars overhead, in a series of stern and impressive acts, including solemn incantations over silver goblets of wine and the lighting of long tapers, the bride and groom were brought together for a ring ceremony and a kiss, much as in a Christian union, under a hand-held canopy of purple velvet. Then the groom ground a wine glass to bits under his heel, and jubilation broke out that made everything before it seem staid and pale. Byron almost became the hero of the evening by putting on a black skullcap and dancing with the yeshiva boys, since there was no dancing with the girls. All the guests gathered to clap and cheer, Natalie in the forefront, her face ablaze with fun. Her knee, healed or forgotten, she joined in the girls' dances, and so she danced, and Byron danced, inside the house and outside, far into the morning hours. Byron scarcely remembered leaving the bride's home and falling asleep on the feather mattress on the floor of the rabbi's house. But there he was when a hand shook him and he opened his eyes. Beryl Jastrow was bending over him, and it took Byron a moment or two to recall where he was and who this man was, with the clever, anxious blue eyes and the long, gray-streaked brown beard. All around him, the yeshiva boys were sitting up and rubbing their eyes, or dressing. The girls were hurrying here and there in their nightclothes. It was hot, and the sun was shining into the room from a clear blue sky.
"Yes, what is it?" he said.
"Der Deutsch," the Jew said. "Les Allemandes."
"Huh? What?"
"The Germans."
Byron sat up, his voice faltering. "Oh, the Germans. What about them?"
"They coming."
World Empire Lost by General Armin von Roon. Adapted from his Land, Sea, and Air Operations of World War II. English translation by Victor Henry. Chapter 9. Translator's Foreword by Victor Henry. I never expected to translate a German military work. For years, like many flag officers, I planned to write up my own experiences in World War II, and in the end, like most of them, I decided against it. It was said of the late Fleet Admiral Ernest King that if it had been up to him, he would have issued a single communique about the Pacific War. We won. My war memoirs boil down more or less to this. I served. Upon retiring from the Navy, I became a consultant to a marine engineering firm. On my last business trip to Germany, in 1965, I noticed in the windows of bookstores, wherever I went, stacks of a small book called World Empire Lost by General Armin von Roon. I distinctly recalled General von Roon from my days of service in Berlin as naval attaché to the American Embassy. I had met him and chatted with him, and he came to one of my wife's frequent dinner parties. He was then on the Armed Forces Operations staff. He had a distant, forbidding manner, a pudgy figure, and a large, beaked nose, almost Semitic, that must have given him some grief. But of course, as his name indicates, he was of Simon pure Prussian descent. He was obviously brilliant, and I always wanted to know him better, but did not get the opportunity. I little thought then how well I would come to know him one day through his book. Out of curiosity, I bought a copy of World Empire Lost, and found it so absorbing that I visited the publisher's office in Munich to learn who had printed it in America. I then discovered that the work had not yet been translated into English. On my return to the States, I induced the publishers of this volume to acquire the English language rights. I was planning to retire from business, and I thought that translating the book might ease the pain of putting myself out to pasture. World Empire Lost is an abstract from a huge two-volume operational analysis of the war, written by General von Roon in prison. He called it Land, Sea, and Air Campaigns of World War II, and he had plenty of time to write it. For at Nuremberg, he got 20 years, for complicity in war crimes on the Eastern Front. This exhaustive technical work is not available in an English translation, and I doubt that it will be. Roon prefaced his account of each major campaign with a summary of the strategic and political background. These brief sketches, pulled out and compiled by the publisher after his death, constitute World Empire Lost. I doubt that the general would have approved of that melodramatic title. World Empire Lost is, therefore, not solid military history, but rather a sort of publisher's stunt. It runs together Roon's sweeping assertions about world politics in one short volume, and omits the meticulous military analysis that backed them. However, I believe the result is readable, interesting, and valuable. The remarkable thing about the book is its relative honesty. Nearly all the German military literature glosses over the killing of the Jews, the responsibility for the war, and Hitler's hold on the army and the people. About all these sticky questions, Roon writes with calm frankness. He planned to withhold his work from publication, and did, until he was safely dead and buried. So, unlike most German military writers, he was not trying either to save his neck or placate the victors. The result is a revelation of how the Germans really felt, and may well still feel, about Hitler's war. Here, then, is a German general leveling, insofar as he can do so. Roon was an able writer, much influenced by the best French and British military authors, especially de Gaulle and Churchill. His German is more readable than that of most of his countrymen who write on military matters. I hope I have at least partly conveyed this in translation. My own style, formed in a lifetime of writing U.S. Navy reports, has inevitably crept in here and there, but I trust no substantial distortion has resulted. This author, to my mind, portrays the Germans under Hitler as they were, a remarkably tough and effective fighting nation, not a horde of stupid sadists or comic bunglers, as popular entertainment now tends to caricature them. For 6 years, these people battled almost the whole world to a standstill, and they also committed unprecedented crimes. The stake they were gambling for was, in Shakespeare's expressive phrase, nothing less than the great globe itself. What was going on in their minds seems to me of importance. That is why I have translated Roon. His version of events, while professional and well-informed, can scarcely be taken at face value. He was a German, through and through. On the whole, I have let General von Roon describe the war his own way. I could not, however, translate certain passages without challenging them, hence my occasional comments. Roon starts on his first page, for instance, exactly as Adolf Hitler started all his speeches, by denouncing the Versailles Treaty as an injustice imposed on an honorable and trusting Germany by the cruel Allies. He does not mention the historical catch to that. German writers seldom do. In 1917, Lenin overthrew the Kerensky government and sued for a separate peace on the Eastern Front. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, dictated by the Germans over a year before the Treaty of Versailles, deprived Russia of a territory much larger than France and England combined, of almost 60 million inhabitants, and of almost all her heavy industry. It was far harsher than the Versailles Treaty. I used to bring up this little fact during my Berlin service whenever Versailles was mentioned. My German friends were invariably puzzled by the comparison. They thought it made no sense at all. The Treaty of Versailles had happened to them. Brest-Litovsk had happened to the other fellow. In this reaction, they were sincere. I cannot explain this national quirk of the Germans, but it should never be forgotten in reading World Empire Lost. Victor Henry, Oakton, Virginia, 27 May, 1966. Case White, The Responsibility for Hitler. In writing this book, I have only one aim, to defend the honor of the German soldier. To trace the rise of Adolf Hitler, our leader in World War II, is not necessary here. No story of the 20th century is better known. When the victorious Allies in 1919 created the crazy Treaty of Versailles, they also created Hitler. Germany in 1918, relying on the 14 points of the American President Wilson, honorably laid down arms. The Allies treated the 14 points as a scrap of paper and wrote a treaty that partitioned Germany and made an economic and political madhouse of Europe. In thus outwitting the naive American president and butchering up the map, the British and French politicians probably imagined they would paralyze the German nation forever. The cynical policy boomeranged. Winston Churchill himself has called the Versailles settlement a sad and complicated idiocy. The oppression of Versailles built up in the vigorous German people a volcanic resentment. It burst forth, and Adolf Hitler rode to power on the crest of the eruption. The Nazi Party, a strange alliance of radicals and conservatives, of wealthy men and down-and-outers, was united only on the ideal of a resurgent Germany, and unfortunately on the old Middle European political slogan of discontent, anti-Semitism. A riff-raff of vulgar agitators, philosophic idealists, fanatics, opportunists, bullies, and adventurers, some of them extremely able and energetic, swept into power with Hitler. We of the general staff, for the most part, watched these turbid political events with distaste and foreboding. Our loyalty was to the state, however it was governed, but we feared a wave of weakening social change. It is fair to say that Hitler surprised us. Swiftly, without bloodshed, this brilliant and inspiring politician repaired one injustice of Versailles after another. His methods were direct and strong. The Weimar regime had tried other methods and had met only with contempt from Britain and France. Hitler's methods worked. Inside Germany, he was equally strict and harsh when needed. Here, too, the methods worked, and if historians now call his regime a terror, one must concede that it was then a popular terror. Hitler brought prosperity, and he rearmed us. He was a man with a mission. His burning belief in himself and in his mission swayed the German masses. Though he usurped much power, the masses would probably have granted it all to him freely anyway. Case read. Naturally, the swift renaissance of Germany under Hitler created anger and dismay among the Allies. France, war-weary, luxury-loving, and rotted by socialism, was reluctant to take effective action. England was another matter. England still ruled the world with her global navy, her international money system, her alliances, and her empire on five continents. In ascending to mastery of Europe and upsetting the balance of power, Germany was once more challenging her for world rule. This was the confrontation of the Great War again. Nothing could avert this showdown, for Germany early in the 20th century had passed England in both population and industrial plant. In this sense, Churchill correctly calls the Second World War a continuation of the first one, and both conflicts together, another 30 years' war. We of the German General Staff knew that at some point in Hitler's spectacular normalizing of Europe, England would intervene. The only questions were, when and under what circumstances? Already in 1937, we had prepared a plan for a two-front war against England and Poland. Voll rot. Case read. We kept updating it as Adolf Hitler scored one bloodless victory after another, and our strategic situation and armed strength improved by leaps, while Britain and France contented themselves with feeble, scolding protests. We began to hope that the forceful Führer might actually bring his new order to Europe without bloodshed, by default of the perpetrators of Versailles. Had this occurred, he could have launched his grand crusade against the Soviet Union for living space in the East, the aim of his life, as a one-front war. History would have followed a different course. But on March 31, 1939, a day that the world should not forget, all this changed. The British Prime Minister, Chamberlain, suddenly gave Poland an unconditional guarantee of military assistance. His pretext was anger at Hitler for breaking his promise not to occupy the weak fragment of Czechoslovakia left after the Munich partition, the deal which Chamberlain himself had engineered. Hitler's promises, like those of all politicians, were merely contingent and tactical, of course. It was asinine of Chamberlain to think otherwise, if he did. Whatever the motive for the Polish guarantee, it was a piece of suicidal stupidity. It stiffened the corrupt Polish army oligarchy to stand fast on the just German grievances involving Danzig and the Polish corridor. It placed in the hands of these backward militarists the lever to start another world war. Otherwise, it had no meaning, because in the event, England was unable to give Poland actual military help. With Russian participation, the guarantee might have made sense. In fact, it might have stopped Hitler in his tracks, because he feared above all things, as the General Staff also did, a two-front war. But the British gentlemen politicians disdained the Bolsheviks, and Poland, in any case, utterly refused to consider admitting Russian protective troops. So, foolishness and weakness joined hands to trigger the catastrophe. For Chamberlain's defiant move, like the weak pawing of a cornered rabbit, only spurred the Führer to greater boldness. Like lightning, down came the word to our staff to prepare an operation order for an attack on Poland in the fall. Working day and night, with Case Red as a basis, we prepared the plan. On April 5th, it went to the Führer under a new code name, Vollweiss, Case White. Historic Ironies. Case White, the plan for smashing Poland, shaped itself on a few major and classic geographical facts. Poland is a plain. A larger Belgium with few natural obstacles and no real boundaries. The Carpathian Mountains to the south are breached by the Jablunka Pass, affording ready access from Czechoslovakia to Krakow and the Vistula. The rivers Vistula, Narev, and San present problems, but in the summer and early autumn, the water levels are low, and the rivers are in many places fordable by motor vehicles and horses. Poland is itself a political freak, reflecting its formless geography. It has no permanent shape, no continuity of regime or national purpose. It has several times disappeared from the map of Europe, divided up as provinces of stronger and abler powers. Today it is again little more than a Russian province. At Yalta, the Allied leaders moved the entire crude geographical parallelogram called Poland about 200 kilometers to the west, to the Oder-Neisse line. This was done at the expense of Germany, of course, giving to Poland cities, territories, and populations which had been German from time immemorial, and causing the tragic uprooting and resettling of millions of people. Such is war. To the victor, the spoils. To the defeated, the costs. The Second World War began over the question of Polish territorial integrity, but Poland has not recovered and will never recover its 1939 borders. It has lost that part of its territory, which, through the deal between Hitler and Stalin, was absorbed into the Soviet Union. England went to war with us over the question of these borders, dragging in France and eventually the United States. At Yalta, England and the United States endorsed forever Hitler's gift of Polish territory to the Soviets. Such are the ironies of history. The Polish strategic situation in 1939 was poor. The entire land could be regarded as a weak salient into Germany and German-occupied territory, flanked by East Prussia to the north and Czechoslovakia to the south, and wholly flat and open to a thrust from Germany to the west. To the rear, in the east, the Soviet Union stood poised, newly linked to Germany through the non-aggression pact engineered by Ribbentrop. The Fatal Pact. Insufficient attention is paid to the plain fact that this treaty, hailed at the time as a masterstroke, all but lost Germany the Second World War before a shot was fired. The alliance with Bolshevism, however temporary and tactical, was certainly a repudiation of the dictator's ideals, running counter to the German national spirit. But this might have been allowable had the tactical advantage proved real. In politics, as in war, only success matters. But the contrary was the case. This pact handed Stalin the Baltic states and about half of Poland, allowing the Slav horde to march 200 kilometers nearer Germany. 2 years later, we paid the price. In December 1941, the gigantic drive of our Army Group Center toward Moscow, the greatest armed march in world history, was halted 40 kilometers from its goal, with advance patrols penetrating within sight of the Kremlin towers. Had the German forces jumped off from a line 200 kilometers nearer Moscow, they would have engulfed the Russian capital, deposed Stalin, and won the campaign before the first flake of snow fell on the Smolensk Road. England certainly would have made peace then, and we would have won the war. Regarded as a triumph of daring diplomacy even by our enemies, this treaty contained between its lines the two words, Finis Germaniae. Seldom in history has there been such a political coup d'état. Seldom has one so disastrously backfired. Yet we of the staff who ventured to express doubts at the time, or merely to convey with our eyes our mutual dismay at the news, were very much in the minority. No member of the armed forces, including Hitler's own chief of staff, Keitel, and the chief of operations, Jodl, knew of the secret protocol yielding half of Poland to the Bolsheviks. It was only when Stalin angrily telephoned Ribbentrop in the third week of the campaign, bitterly complaining about the advance of our 14th Army into the southeast oil area, that the Wehrmacht received its specific chop lines and retreated before the Russians, who airily rolled in without shedding a drop of their own or of Polish blood. It was I who received at Supreme Headquarters the staggering telephone call from our military attaché in Moscow around midnight of September 16th, informing me that the Russians were marching into Poland in accordance with a secret agreement Hitler had made in August. I immediately telephoned General Jodl with the news that the Russians were on the move. His response, in a tremulous voice most uncharacteristic of Alfred Jodl, was, "Against whom?" So completely was the army in the dark. In the last few days of August, as Case White preparations speeded up, Hitler tried to cash in on Ribbentrop's big political surprise with a comedy of peace negotiations. In the spring, in a calmer mood, he had stated with his usual prescience that the Western powers would not again permit a bloodless victory, that this time there would be battle. We had prepared Case White with feelings varying from misgivings to a sense of doom, because our combat readiness was much below par for a major conflict. We were so low on tanks, to cite just one key item, that even for Case White, we had to deploy large numbers of Czech tanks of limited value. And the Navy had only about 50 submarines ready for action. Worst of all, the Führer was far from ordering full wartime production, even then, for he knew it would be an unpopular move. All in all, we were going out on very thin ice. The staff placed no hope in the peace talks. Hitler, however, while going through his planned histrionics with Henderson, apparently got carried away by his own play-acting and the constant assurances of Ribbentrop. He began to believe that England might be bluffed once more and might present us with another Munich. At Supreme Headquarters, in the first days of September, nobody could fail to notice that when the Western declarations of war came through, the Führer was surprised and shaken. But there was nothing to do at that point but execute Case White. Strategy. The plan called for simultaneous flank attacks from the north and the south, aimed to cut off the corridor and proceed to Warsaw. The Poles elected to stand all along their indefensible border, thus inviting quick fragmenting, encirclement, and reduction. They should have prepared their main defenses along the lines Vistula-Narev-Bug. This would have prolonged hostilities and encouraged the British and French to attack our weak holding force in the west. This could have been devastating. Adventurous, authoritarian leadership had exposed the German people to a bad risk. However, the gods smiled on us at the time. The Poles proved as inept in their strategic dispositions as they were brave in the field, and the French sat in their camps and fortresses, scarcely firing a shot. Nowadays, German commentators write of the miracle of the French static defense in September 1939, which made the Polish blitzkrieg possible. It is hard to see where the miracle lay. French military thinking was defensive and positional, because such thinking had triumphed in 1918. They had an obsession with the theoretical 10-to-1 advantage of the defense in mechanized warfare. There is no doubt that in September, France could have sent millions of well-trained soldiers with more armored divisions than the Wehrmacht had in Poland, crashing out of the Maginot fortresses, or via the northern plain through Belgium and Holland, into our paper-thin western formations, and rolled to Berlin. But the will was not there. Adolf Hitler's political and military gamble on this vital point proved brilliant. Of all his opponents, he throughout best understood and anticipated the French. Victory. The Polish breakthrough phase took approximately 4 days. Complete tactical surprise was achieved because the hypocritical Polish politicians, though wholly aware of the danger, kept giving their people false assurances. The Polish Air Force of almost 1,000 planes was destroyed on the ground. Thereafter, the Luftwaffe freely roamed the skies. Polish ground resistance was moderate to heavy, and our commanders in the field had to admire the bold cavalry dashes against tank formations. Perhaps the legend is true that the Polish horsemen were told by their government that our tanks were papier-mâché dummies. In that case, they were soon sadly disabused. The contrast between the possibilities of mechanized warfare and classic military tactics was never more strikingly demonstrated than in these ineffectual charges of the Polish horsemen against iron tanks. Nevertheless, the Wehrmacht, too, was operating with but a thin knife edge of fully motorized armored divisions. Our important ground advances were made by infantry masses on foot, exploiting the breakdown of communications, the panic, and the disarray of battle lines created by the narrow panzer thrusts. And while the Luftwaffe played a strong support role, it was the horse-drawn artillery, massed outside Warsaw, and not the air bombardment, that in the end knocked out the city's capacity to resist and brought the eventual surrender. This heavy reliance on horses betrayed our serious lack of combat readiness for World War. By September 21st, the city was ringed by Wehrmacht forces, and the news from outside was of Polish soldiers being taken prisoner in the hundreds of thousands, of one pocket after another being liquidated, of a total collapse of the front, of a national government pusillanimously fleeing to Romania. Yet it was not until September 27th that the city, under a round-the-clock rain of shells and bombs, without food, water, or light, with many of its buildings in ruins, with disease spreading, finally gave up its vain hopes of last-minute deliverance from the West and surrendered. Observations. From first to last, the Führer and his propagandists played down the Polish campaign as a local police action, a special task of the Wehrmacht. Hitler personally cancelled many sections of Case White dealing with rationing, troop mobilization, and transport, with one aim in mind, to soften the impact on the German people. This political meddling represented a considerable setback to operations, and precious months passed before the damage was righted. I may say here that due to similar party and Führer interference, which never ceased, the war effort was never, by professional standards, organized fully or properly. The shabby farce enacted at our radio station at Gliwice near the Polish border on the night of August 31st, the pretense that Polish soldiers had crossed over to attack the station and been repulsed, the dressing of condemned political prisoners in Polish uniforms and the scattering of their bullet-riddled bodies near the station as an excuse for starting the invasion, none of this trivial humbug was known to the Wehrmacht. We were irrevocably on the march toward Poland 72 hours earlier. I myself did not learn of the incident until the Nuremberg trials. I was too busy at the time with serious matters. Translator's note. The veracity of this statement is questionable. VH. Himmler was probably responsible. Poland, in 1939, was a backward and ill-informed dictatorship of reactionary colonels and politicians with fantastic territorial aims, a government extremely brutal to minorities, especially the Ukrainians and the Jews, and unjust and mendacious to its own people. A government that pounced like a hyena on Czechoslovakia at the Munich crisis and tore a province from that country in its hardest hour. A government that clumsily played a double game with Germany and the Soviet Union for 20 years, and to the last tried to talk and act like a major military power when it was, in fact, as weak as a kitten. It was to support this reactionary, bluffing, bigoted dictatorship that the democracies embarked on the Second World War. That government quickly and ignominiously fell to pieces and disappeared forever. But the war went on, and its starting point was soon all but forgotten. Someday, however, sober historians must again give the proper emphasis to these absurd paradoxes that governed the provoking of the world's biggest war. The final absurdity of this inept start to a terrible global struggle was that Czechoslovakia, betrayed by England in 1938, did not fight, and in the whole war period lost less than 100,000 people. Poland, supported by England in 1939, fought and lost almost 6 million dead, though about half of these were Jews. Both countries ended up as communist puppets under the heel of the Soviet Union. Which government, then, was the wiser, and which people the more fortunate? When great powers fall out, small powers do well to bow to the storm wind, in whichever direction it blows strongest. That was what the Poles forgot. Translator's note. The reader will have to grow used to the German habit of blaming other countries for getting themselves invaded by Germans. This note recurs throughout General von Roon's book, as through most of their military literature. Officers raised under the general staff system apparently lost the power to think in other terms. Roon's discussion of the Polish government and the British guarantee are the telling passages in his preliminary sketch of Case White. V.H. Chapter 10. German army attacks Poland. Cities bombed. Port blockaded. Danzig is accepted into the Reich. The New York Times, raising its voice to suit the occasion in its 8-column, once-in-a-generation italic headlines, topped the sprawl of newspapers on the desk under Hugh Cleveland's stocking feet. The other papers had headlines far larger and blacker than the Times' genteel bellow. Tilted back in his shirt sleeves in a swivel chair, a telephone cradled between his head and left shoulder, Cleveland was making quick red crayon marks on a sheaf of yellow typing paper and sipping coffee as he talked. 8 years in the broadcasting business had made him deft at such juggling. Though he looked the picture of busy contentment, his voice was angry. His morning show, called Who's in Town, featured interviews with celebrities passing through New York. The war crisis, suddenly roaring into the Columbia broadcasting system, had snatched off Cleveland's secretary to the newsroom for emergency service, and he was protesting to the personnel office, or trying to. He still could not get through to the manager. A short girl in a flat black straw hat appeared in the open doorway. Behind her, in the big central offices of CBS News, the hubbub over the war news was still rising. Secretaries were rattling at typewriters or scampering with papers. Messenger boys ran with coffee and sandwiches. Knots of men in shirt sleeves gathered at the chattering teletypes, and everybody appeared to be either shouting or smoking or both.
"Mr. Cleveland?"
The girl's voice was sweet but shaky. Her awed, round eyes made her look about 16. Cleveland put his hand on the mouthpiece of his telephone.
"Yes."
"The personnel office sent me up to you."
"You? How old are you?"
20.
Cleveland appeared skeptical, but he hung up the telephone.
"What's your name?"
"Madeline Henry."
Cleveland sighed.
"Well, okay, Madeline. If you're in the pool, you must know the ropes. So take off that cartwheel and get started, okay? First, get me another cup of coffee and a chicken sandwich, please. Then there's tomorrow's script."
He wrapped the yellow sheets. "To be typed over."
Madeline could bluff no further. She was in New York to buy clothes. The outbreak of the war had prompted her to walk into CBS to see if extra girls were needed. In the employment office, a harried woman wearing yellow paper cuffs had thrust a slip at her, after a few questions about her schooling, and sent her up to Cleveland.
"Talk to him. If he likes you, he may take you on. He's screaming for a girl, and we've got nobody to spare."
Stepping just inside the door and planting her legs apart, taking off her hat and clutching it, Madeline confessed that nobody had hired her yet. That she was visiting New York, lived in Washington, had to go back to school, detested the thought of it, feared her father too much to do anything else, and had just walked into CBS on an impulse. He listened, smiling and surveying her with eyes half closed. She wore a sleeveless red cotton frock, and she had excellent color from a sailing weekend.
"Well, Madeline, what does it add up to? Do you want the job or not?"
"I was thinking, could I come back in a week or so?"
His pleasant look faded. He picked up the telephone.
"Get me personnel again. Yes, you come back sometime, Madeline."
She said,
"I'll fetch you your coffee and sandwich right now. I can do that. I'll type your script today, too. Couldn't I work for you for 3 weeks? I don't have to go back to school until the 22nd. My father will kill me when he finds out, but I don't care."
"Where's your father, in Washington?"
"He's in Berlin. He's the naval attaché there."
"What?"
Hugh Cleveland hung up the telephone and took his feet off the desk.
"Your father is our naval attaché in Nazi Germany?"
"That's right."
"Imagine that. So, you're a Navy junior."
He threw a $5 bill on the desk.
"All right, get me the sandwich, Madeline, please. White meat, lettuce, pepper, mayonnaise, black coffee, then we'll talk some more. Buy yourself a sandwich, too."
Holding the bill, Madeline rushed into the outer hall and stood there, dazed. Having heard the Who's in Town program a few times, she had at once recognized Cleveland's peculiarly warm, rich voice. A real broadcaster, with his own program, and all at once she was working for him. That was wartime for you. A girl swishing by with a bag of food told her where to buy sandwiches. But 20 chattering girls swarmed at the takeout counter of the luncheonette off the lobby. She went out on Madison Avenue and stood blinking in the warm sunshine. The New York scene was normal. Crowds marched on the sidewalks. Cars and buses streamed both ways in a stench of fumes. People carried packages into and out of stores and looked in windows.
The only novelty was that the news vendors with fresh stacks of afternoon papers were crying war. Madeline ran to the big drugstore across the street, where the soda fountain was jammed with secretaries and shoppers, talking and laughing over bowls of chili or soup. The usual sort of people were wandering through the aisles, buying toothpaste, lotions, aspirin, candy, and cheap clocks. A fat, old blonde woman in an apron and cap quickly made up her sandwiches.
"Well, honey, who's gonna win the war?" she said sociably as she peppered the chicken.
"Let's just hope Hitler doesn't," Madeline said.
"Yes, isn't he something? Sieg Heil! I think the man's crazy. I've always said so, and this proves it."
She handed Madeline the sandwiches.
"Well, honey, so long as we keep out of it, what do we care who wins?"
Madeline bought an evening paper that offered gigantic headlines, but no fresh news. Just to scan such a dramatic front page was novel fun. Though the war was happening so far away, Madeline felt a springtime quickening in her veins. A scent of freedom, of new action, rose from the headlines. The president had announced at once, very firmly, that America was staying out of it. But things were going to be mighty different from now on. That was inevitable. All her thoughts were about the letter she would write to her father. If only she could get this job. Cleveland, feet on his desk again, a flirtatious smirk on his face, was telephoning. He nodded at Madeline and, as he went on coaxing some girl in his warmly rumbling voice to meet him at Toots Shore's restaurant, he wolfed the sandwich.
"Why don't you eat the other one?" Madeline said. "I'm not hungry."
"Are you sure? I don't want to rob you." He hung up and unwrapped her sandwich. "Ordinarily I don't eat much during the day, but with all this war talk—" He took a great bite and went on talking. "Thanks. I swear I'm as hungry as I get at funerals. Ever notice how famished you get at a funeral, Madeline? It's the sheer delight of being alive, I guess, while this other poor joker's just been buried in a dirty hole. Now listen, you want to work for me for 3 weeks. Is that it? That'll be fine. It'll give me a chance to look over what's around in personnel." He flourished a brown envelope at her. "Now then, Gary Cooper is at the St. Regis, room 641. This is a sample Who's in Town script. Take it to him. We may get him for Thursday."
"Gary Cooper? You mean the movie star?"
Madeline, in astonishment, zoomed words like her mother.
"Who else? He may ask you questions about the show and about me, so listen and get this rundown in your head. We work without an audience in a little studio, very relaxed. It's a room with armchairs, books, and a rug, really nice, like a library in a home. It's the same room Mrs. Roosevelt uses for her show. We can do the script in extra big type if he needs that. He can take 5 minutes or 15. The whole show runs an hour and a half. I started this show in Los Angeles back in 34 and did it there for 3 years. I called it Over the Coffee then. Maybe he heard it. Of course, he may be too busy to go into all that. Anyway, act as though you've been with the show for a while."
Too dazzled and excited to talk, Madeline held out her hand for the envelope. Cleveland gave it to her, saying,
"All set? Anchors away. For Christ's sake, don't ask him for his autograph. Telephone me if there's any holdup. Don't fail to reappear."
Madeline blurted, "You must have had some very stupid girls working for you," and hurried out. A maid opened the door of the hotel suite, where Gary Cooper, in a gray suit, sat eating lunch at a wheeled table. The star rose, immensely tall and slim, smiling down at Madeline. He put on black-rimmed glasses, glanced over the script as he drank coffee, and asked questions. He was all business, the farthest thing from a bashful cowboy. He had the manner of an admiral. When she mentioned the over-the-coffee show, he brightened.
"Yes, I remember that."
Almost at once, it seemed, she was out on the sunny street again, overwrought, thrilled to her bones.
"England mobilizes! Hitler smashes into Poland!"
the news vendor at the corner hoarsely chanted.
"Bless your little heart,"
Cleveland said as she came into the office. He was banging rapidly at a typewriter.
"Cooper just called. He likes the idea and he's in."
Ripping the yellow sheet out of the machine, he clipped it with the others. "He remarked on what a nice girl you were. What did you say to him?"
Hardly anything. Well, you did a good job. I'm off to interview him now. There's tomorrow's script. Do a smooth copy of the red-checked pages, then get the whole thing to Mimeo Instanter, room 309A. Cleveland stepped into his shoes, straightened his tie, and threw on a rust-colored sports jacket. He scratched his heavy blonde hair and grinned at her, raising thick, humorously arched eyebrows. She felt she would do anything for him. He was charming, she decided, rather than actually handsome. There was something infectiously jovial about him, a spark of devilish amusement in his lively blue eyes. She was a bit disappointed to see, when he stood up, that though he could not be more than 31 or so, his stomach bulged. But it didn't matter. He paused at the door. "Do you mind working nights? You'll get paid overtime. If you come back here around 8:30 tonight, you'll find Thursday's rough on my desk, with the Cooper spot."
"Mr. Cleveland, I haven't been hired yet."
"You have been. I just talked to Mrs. Hennessy. After you get that script to Mimeo, go down and fill out your papers."
Madeline toiled for 5 hours to finish the script. She turned it in, messy though her work was, hoping it would not end her radio career then and there. At the employment office, she learned she was starting at $35 a week. It seemed a fortune. She took her aching back to the drugstore, made a quick dinner of a chocolate drink and a bacon and tomato sandwich, and walked back to CBS. Over the tall black Madison Avenue buildings, checkered with gold-lit windows, a misty full moon floated in a sunset sky. This day, when Hitler's war began, was turning out the most delightful in Madeline Henry's life. On Cleveland's desk, the interview with Gary Cooper now lay, a mass of crude typing, quick scrawls, and red crayon cuts. The note clipped to it said, "Try to copy it all overnight. See you around 10. Madeline groaned. She was terribly tired. She put in a call to Warren at the bachelor's officers' quarters of the Pensacola Flying School. He wasn't there. But an operator with a southern accent, like a vaudeville imitation, offered to track him down. In the smoky newsroom, girls kept crisscrossing with long teletype strips or cups of coffee. Men were talking loud and fast, and the typewriter din never stopped. Through the open door, Madeline heard contradictory rumors. Poland was already collapsing. Hitler was on his way to Warsaw. Mussolini was flying to Berlin. The French were pressing England for another Munich deal. Hitler was offering to visit Chamberlain. The telephone rang at 10 o'clock, and there was Warren on the line, with music and laughter in the background. He was at the beach club, he said, at a moonlight dance on a terrace lined with palm trees. He had just met a marvelous girl, the daughter of a congressman. Madeline told him about the CBS job, and he seemed amused and impressed. "Say, I've heard of Who's in Town," he said. "This fellow, Hugh Cleveland, has an interesting voice. What's he like?"
"Oh, very nice. Do you think it's all right? Will Dad be furious?"
"Maddie, you'll be back at school in 3 weeks before he even knows about it. Where will you stay?"
"Oh, yes, there's an all-woman hotel. I know that one."
"Little Madeline on the town."
"You don't object?"
"Me? Why, I think it's fine. Just be a good girl and all that.
What's the word at CBS, Madeline? Is the war on?
The scuttlebutt down here is that England is chickening out."
Nothing but rumors here, too. 12 an hour."
"Is your date really the daughter of a congressman?" "You bet. And she is a dish.
Tough life you're leading. How's the flying coming?"
"I ground-looped on my second solo landing, but don't write Dad that. I'm doing better now. It's great."
"Good, you're still here,"
Cleveland said, walking into the office a few minutes after this conversation. With him was a tall beauty in a black straw hat, much wider than Madeline's, and a gray silk dress. Her gardenia perfume was too strong for the small office. Cleveland glanced at Madeline's typed pages.
Need a little practice, huh?"
"I warm up as I go along."
Her voice trembled. She cleared her throat.
"Let's hope so. Now look, do you by any chance know of an admiral named Preble? Is he some high mucky muck?"
"Preble? Do you mean Stuart Preble?" Stuart Preble, exactly. Who is he?
Why, he's the chief of naval operations.
That's a big job, huh?
Madeline was used to civilian ignorance of the armed forces, but this shocked her.
Mr. Cleveland, there's nobody higher in the United States Navy.
I just found out he's at the Warwick.
We keep tabs on the big hotels, Madeline. Now, let's get off a letter to him.
He leaned on the edge of the desk and started to dictate. The yawning beauty crossed glorious legs, lit a cigarette, and leafed the Hollywood Reporter. Madeline desperately tried to keep up, but had to plead with him to go slower.
Don't you know shorthand?
I can learn it quickly enough.
Cleveland glanced at his watch and at the beauty, who drooped her eyelids contemptuously at Madeline.
Madeline felt like a worm. Cleveland rumpled his hair and shook his head.
Look, you know these Navy characters. Write him a letter, that's all. Invite him to come on the Thursday morning show. Mention Gary Cooper, if you want to. Sign my name and take it over to the Warwick. Can you do that?
Certainly.
Fine. Wendy and I want to catch a 10 o'clock movie. She plays a bit in it. Say, this Preble fellow, does he know your father? How about that, Wendy? This kid's father is our Navy attaché in Berlin.
Wendy yawned. Madeline said coldly, Admiral Preble knows my father.
Well, how about mentioning that, then?
He gave her his persuasive, impish smile.
I'd really like to get him, Madeline. Admirals and generals are usually crappy guests, too cautious and stiff to say anything interesting. But there's a war on, so for the moment they're hot. See you in the morning. I go on at 9, you know, so get here not later than 8.
As he had told Madeline, Warren was dancing away this first night of the war in moonlight with a congressman's pretty daughter. The moon floats out in space, some 30 diameters of the earth away, shining on the just and the unjust as the cloud cover allows. It had lent dim but helpful light to the columns of young Germans in gray uniforms, miles and miles long, trudging across the Polish border. Now Europe had rolled into the sun, giving the Germans better illumination to get on with the work. And the same moon was bathing the Gulf of Mexico and the terrace of Pensacola's Harbor View Club. The German general staff had carefully planned on the moonlight, but the silver glow fell on Warren Henry and Janice LaCouture by a pleasant chance. Everyone said it was the best club dance in years. The big headlines, the excited radio broadcasts, had created a pleasurable stir in flat, quiet Pensacola. The student aviators felt more important, and the girls found them more glamorous. War was in the air, and however remote the combat, these were warriors. The talk about the German attack soon gave way to homier topics, however. The horse show, the new base commander, recent flying accidents, recent romances. Der Führer, for these happy people, remained the queer, hoarse German of the newsreels, with the wild gestures and the funny mustache, who had managed to start up a European mess, but who could scarcely menace the United States just yet. Lieutenant Junior Grade Henry took a different view. The invasion really interested him, and that was how he first caught the interest of Janice LaCouture. At the academy, he had excelled on the subject of the World War. They sat in a far corner of the terrace in the moonlight soon after they met, and instead of talking aviation or making a pass at her, this student pilot told her about the Schlieffen plan to capture Paris, and the way von Moltke had fatally tampered with it, about the feat of German railroading that had made the Tannenberg victory possible, about the strategic parallels of 1914 and 1939. He had begun with the usual aviator chit-chat, which, after years of Pensacola dating, stupefied Janice. But once they began on the war, and she allowed her own knowledge of history and politics to show, he turned serious. It had been an exciting talk, the sort in which lovers sometimes discover each other without speaking a romantic word. Despite the big LaCouture nose, a mark of French ancestry, and rather irregular front teeth, Janice was one of the belles of Pensacola. Her mouth, skin, and hazel eyes were lovely. Her figure so striking that all men automatically stared at her as at a fire. She was tall, blonde, with a soft, purring voice, and a very lively manner. Her family owned the largest house in the club estates. The La Coutures were solidly rich, from two generations in the timbering that had destroyed the Gulf pine forests for hundreds of miles, and turned northern Florida into a sandy, insect-swarming waste. Her father was a wonder in somnolent and self-satisfied Pensacola, the first La Couture who had ever bestirred himself in politics. In Washington, Janice had grown up far-seeing and sober. She had majored in economics and American history at George Washington University, and she was about to start law school. She wanted to marry a public man, a congressman, a senator, a governor. With luck, why not a future president? This was hard on the young men who fell for her beauty and chic. Janice was out for big game, and she had acquired a reputation for frostiness, which amused her. The last thing she had expected was to meet anybody worth knowing during her enforced summer in Pensacola. And of all people, a naval aviator. Nevertheless, there was something different about Warren Henry. He was oddly appealing, with those penetrating eyes, bony ramshackle frame, gray-sprinkled hair, and easy smile, with its hint of shrewdness and immorality. He acted as though he knew women far too well for an inapt